We've been going through a series in Ephesians where we've really taken a deep dive on the scriptures in Ephesians. And this week, after several different conversations and some prayer, the thought was to introduce a different subject today. And perhaps it's somewhat like a prequel to a previous message, in that we've had a previous message regarding Be a Finisher. That was the title of my sermon during the feast this year, and similar to messages that we've explored here in Phoenix Northwest. And the notion of Be a Finisher is that we've been invited to become sons and daughters of God and to dine at a marriage banquet as the bride of Christ and to be incorporated into the God family for eternity. And in order to be a finisher, we need to first be a starter. And we need to understand that what God is doing now is he's preparing us for that time. And so the title of today's message is You Are Important to God. The question that we will explore today is, what can God do with you if you are willing to say yes? Has anybody ever heard of the story, The Boy Who Shared His Lunch? There's a little bit of presumption in the story that it was a boy who gave up his lunch in Mark 6. But if we turn to Mark 6, we'll pick up the context of a story here, where Christ is with his disciples now. He's starting his ministry, and he's trained them. And at this point now, he's coming to the Sabbath in chapter 6 of Mark, and he's beginning to teach in the synagogue. And many who heard him were astonished. They're saying, wait a minute, we know this guy. Isn't he Joseph's son? Isn't he the carpenter? We know his brothers and sisters. How can he teach like this? This is shocking. And so then in verse 6, he says, he went about the villages in a circuit teaching. So Christ went teaching, and more than that, he calls his 12 to him in verse 7. So these are the men that we've talked about as 12 ordinary men. 12 men that had one thing in common, and that was their ordinariness. They weren't part of the intelligentsia of the time or the academia. They weren't part of any of the higher end of the social structure. They were working men who were willing to respond to Christ's call to follow him. And so he gave them a job to do. He divided them up two by two, and he says, I want you guys to go to these different church areas and speak. And so they did. And then we're going to jump now to verse 30. So they all came back. And when the apostles had gathered to Jesus and started to tell him all things, both of what they had done and what they had taught. And so they're, you can imagine that they're probably pretty excited. They just got back from their first tour of duty, so to speak, and their first mission to go and preach God's truth. And he said to them, okay, come aside by yourselves. Let's go somewhere out of town and rest for a while. For there were many people coming and going, so they were probably getting interrupted. And they did not even have time to eat. So they departed to a deserted place in the boat by themselves. So they got in a boat and paddled away a little bit. And you can imagine the lively conversation that was occurring as they're all telling different stories. But the multitude saw them departing, and many knew him and ran there on foot from the cities. And they arrived before them and came together. And Jesus, when he saw them all gathering on the shore, had compassion on them because they were like a sheep having no shepherd. So he started to teach them. They came to learn. So you can imagine him saying to the disciples, well, guys, we're going to have to finish this conversation later. We've got work to do. Let's go to work. There's these people here. Let's teach them. And so he taught them. And As he started to teach them, it started to get late. When the day was now far spent, his disciples came to him and said, this is a deserted place and it's already getting late. Can we get something to eat? They were hungry already, and now it's several hours later. It's probably getting close to evening, and they're hungry. And so they're starting to say something. What are we going to do to eat? And they make sure they present it properly. The people are going to be very hungry. And he says, well, you give them something to eat. He was feeding them spiritually, and Christ said, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. So he's doing his job, and now they're physically hungry. He says, you give them something to eat. I said, how are we supposed to do that? And if we went to Costco and spent all the money we had and brought the food here, it wouldn't be enough for all of these people. There are 5,000 men, plus all the women and children. And he says, well, what do we have? So they went and found out, 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. Now, this is where a little conjecture comes in. Where did this come from? And is it possible that nobody in the whole audience had any bread or any other food? Maybe others did. Maybe they thought, well, you know, I've got a little bit of food here, but it's barely enough for us, and certainly wouldn't do any good for everyone, so why would we give that up? Yet somehow, somewhere out there, there was a family, maybe a little boy, who said, we've got this, we could share this. Maybe his parents said, yeah, go ahead. Why don't you go give it to them? And that offering, that humble little offering, turned out to be something incredibly special. He commanded them to make them all sit down in groups on the grass. So they sat down in ranks, in hundreds and fifties. So they put some organization together here for the distribution of this food. And when he had taken the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven, blessed and broke the loaves and gave them to his disciples to set before the people. And the 2 fish he divided among them all. So they all ate and were filled, and they took up 12 baskets full of fragments and of the fish. Now those who had eaten the loaves were 5,000 men. Again, a much bigger group. So we see something that seemed incredibly insignificant. But because someone was willing to say yes and give their food, God was able to accomplish his will at a magnitude that could have never been imagined because of that small offering. What can God do with your offering? Isaiah 6 records the story of Isaiah. And Isaiah, at this point, had been called to be a prophet. He was starting to deliver the message that God wanted him to deliver. And in Isaiah 6, he has a vision. And so we pick up the story, verse 1 of chapter 6. In that year King Uzziah died, I saw, this is first person Isaiah, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above it stood seraphim. Each one had 6 wings. With 2 he covered his face, with 2 he covered his feet, and with 2 he flew. Now, interestingly enough, last night we were having a conversation and saw an artist impression of these seraphim. And they're a little weird, a little interesting to see a body with 6 wings and 2 covering their face and the flying and all that. So you can imagine that he's taking all of this in, but it's spectacular and amazing. And so he hears them saying, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And so the posts of the door were shaken by the voice of him who cried out, and the house was filled with smoke. So Isaiah says, woe is me, for I'm undone, because I'm a man of unclean lips. He's saying, I'm unworthy to even be here. And I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. So he's just shocked that he is seeing this firsthand. And he just feels unworthy, and he doesn't feel like he has anything to give. And one of the seraphim flew to me, first person in Isaiah, having in his hand a live coal which he had taken with tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth with it and said, behold, this has touched your lips. Your iniquity is taken away and your sin purged. And we know and understand that there's a process for that. And Acts 2:38 and Acts 3:19 both refer to the process of repenting and being baptized, and being cleansed of sin. Acts 3:19 says, so that times of refreshing can come from the Lord. And that there's a promise associated with that. So he says, his tongue is touched and his iniquity is purged. Verse 8, I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send and whom shall go for us? So this is the Godhead saying, who do we send to deliver this message? And then Isaiah said, here I am, send me. And he said, go and tell the people. So Isaiah volunteered. He said, I'll do it. I'm in. I'm willing. And he signed up for a life full of challenges from that point forward. He had to deliver a message that the people did not want to hear. It was God's message, yet they weren't entirely obeying God. They were doing things their own way. They were full of self-will. And he had to say, this doesn't end well for you. This is not what pleases God. And you know what God wants, but you're not doing it. That was the message he had to give. The message that he gave and the words in Isaiah and the prophecies of what would happen are instructive to us today. Isaiah is a pivotal prophet in prophecy and in the establishment of doctrine and our understanding. So his effect, the effect of him, his willingness to say, here I am, Lord, affects us still today. There was a young man in the Old Testament that was the youngest of all of his brothers. He was tending sheep, doing the jobs that they had graduated from. And we know how that works in a family where jobs get passed down. And so he was now the one taking care of the sheep. And one day he was out there and somebody came running up and said, David, we need you to come with us. I need you to come with me. Your dad's looking for you. He says, what about the sheep? Just leave them. Come right away. So they go running back, and there's all of his brothers, probably not looking incredibly happy. And Samuel, this guy Samuel, who says, this is the one, and he pours oil on his head. Let's turn to 1 Samuel, pick up the story. So this is in 1 Samuel 16, and you can read that at another time. I'd like to pick up the message a little later than that, and I'll skim through it, and then we'll get to some specific scriptures. So David was the son of Jesse, and Jesse would send him from time to time from the sheep in Bethlehem to the front lines where Saul's army was fighting the Philistines. And he would say, take some food to your brothers. I need you to take care of them. So he would do that. David would head up there. And this specific time that we pick up in 1 Samuel 17 was one of those times where David was sent to the front line. And he rose early in the morning. Now we're in 1 Samuel 17:20. And he left the sheep with the keeper. And he took the things and went as his father had commanded him. And he gets to the camp as the army was going out to fight and shouting for the battle. For the Israel and the Philistines had drawn up in battle array, army against army. So David leaves his supplies in the hand of the supply keeper, and he runs to the army, and he comes and greets his brothers here on the front line. And then, as he talked with them, there was the champion, the Philistine, Goliath by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines, and he spoke according to these words, the words that he had been challenging the armies of Israel with for 40 days. David hears these, and he says, what is this? Who is, now I'm jumping down to verse 26. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And his brothers are angry with him. They said, David, just keep your mouth shut. You'll get yourself killed. And this is Eliab. When he heard this, he spoke to the men, and he was angry with David. And he says, why did you come down here? And why aren't you taking care of the sheep? Why aren't you handling dad's business? What are you doing here? And he says, I know your pride. I know your heart. You've come to see the battle. And David says, That's not it. And then Saul hears about this and he calls David to him. And David says, "Let no man's heart fail because of Goliath. Your servant will go and fight with him." And Saul says, "You'll get yourself killed. That's not a good idea." And he says, "Well, I've said yes before. When there was a bear attacking the sheep, I killed that bear. When there was a lion attacking that sheep, I killed that lion. And this, God will help me prevail against this Philistine because he's threatening his armies." So David, Saul says, "Go and the Lord be with you." And then he tries to give him the tools of the trade at the time. "I'll give you my armor. I'll give you everything. I'll give you my sword. You can go battle him." David tries it on and says, "This doesn't work. This isn't the way I fight, and this isn't the way I'll win. It has to be clear that it's coming from God. And so I can't have any of this. The deliverance will be from God." He understood. In verse 37, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." Verse 47, jump across the page. "Then all the assembly shall know, once he's victorious, that the Lord does not save with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give," he was talking to Goliath now, "he will give you into our hands." So Goliath came up and said, "Okay then, let's do this." And as he came towards David, we know David with a sling slung a stone at him and it sunk into his forehead. So this is the way David, the Lord, delivered Israel from the hand of Goliath and the Philistines and delivered them a great victory that day, because David was willing to say yes and let the Lord do the fighting through him. Another inspirational story in the Bible is of Esther. At Challenger Program this year, every one of the participants shared a story of someone that was meaningful to them and who had faced challenges. And Esther was presented by Lisa, who was on the hike. And she went through this story, and we're going to pick up this story in Esther 4. And we remember that at this point, Esther is now the queen of Persia. And there's an issue here. And this goes back to, we just finished a story in 1 Samuel 17. But if we go back to 1 Samuel 15, we have a story of Saul, who was told by God to go and utterly destroy the Amalekites, which he did not do. And he saved King Hu of the Amalekites. Agag? King Agag of the Amalekites? Okay. So King Agag, he saved. And Saul did not utterly destroy everything and everyone as he was commanded to do. And for that reason, the kingdom was ripped from his hands and given to David. So that was a little bit of the backstory. And now let's take a look at Esther 3 and verse 10. We're now dealing with the setting of the story where this man Haman, who's part of the court of the king here, let's see who he is. He is Haman, the son of Hammathada, the Agagite. So if we now combine this history together, we start to see what's going on here. So the Amalekites attacked Israel when they were leaving Egypt from behind. It was considered cowardly and not the right thing to do, not the right way to fight. And so God had a special issue with the Amalekites, and he was ready to resolve it with Saul, and he says, "Go and utterly destroy them. I want them all gone. Don't take anything from them. We don't want any Israelite to think they were made wealthy from the Amalekites. Just kill everything." That was God's judgment. He has the right to judge. And yet that was not done. And so now we have Haman, a descendant. Somebody must have escaped, and now he's a descendant, and he comes up with a plot to utterly destroy the Jews. We see his motive. And so Mordecai hears about all of this. Now we're picking it up in chapter 4. And he tears his clothes and he puts on sackcloth and ashes. And he goes into the midst of the city and cries with a loud voice. And he went to the king's gate, but he couldn't get into the compound there to talk to Esther. So he finally gets someone to take a message to her. And he says, "You need to go to the king and let him know of this plan." So now we'll pick it up in Esther 4 and verse 10. So Esther said, and it says, "Relay this message to my uncle. All the king's servants and all the people of the provinces know that any man or woman who goes to the king who has not been called, he has but one law: put them to death, except to the one he holds out the golden scepter." So here's a human reaction, like, wait a minute, I could die doing this. So Mordecai says something to her, and this is instructive for all of us, because perhaps this type of message could apply to us in some way. Mordecai says, "Answer Esther, do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. God will use someone else. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Perhaps you have been called for this purpose. Whatever that purpose is, by the way, the purpose may be set in front of you at some point. A request may come to you. Can you contribute in this way? There's a need. We have a need. You may get that phone call, you may get that text, you may get that email, and there's a request. Can you step into this? I could use your help. Somebody could use your help. And it may feel like this. Well, I'm not sure. There could be reasons why not. Remember the Esther 4:14. It's a very human response to be reluctant, to be hesitant, to dig in a little bit, to share the reasons why not. If we turn over to Exodus 3, we see another very human reaction to a request to step into a role of service. And we can see what happens here. It is kind of natural to counterbalance someone's optimism or enthusiasm with some level of reluctance or pessimism. And everyone knows what the definition of a pessimist is, right? Someone who's married to an optimist. And you might recognize that pattern of communications and behavior. "I have an idea." Oh, boy. Right away, you know what's going to come. And so this can happen in all sorts of contexts. But here we're going to see Moses entering into a new phase of life. We might remember Moses, the division of Moses' life. The first 40 years, he was a prince of Egypt. And then he started to recognize who he was, and he started to identify with the Israelites. And he saw what the Egyptians were doing to the Israelites, and it frustrated him so much that he killed an Egyptian that was abusing an Israelite, and he had to leave. So that started the next 40 years where he was in exile, and he went out into the desert, and he got married, found a wife, and he was working for his father-in-law, tending sheep. And now it's been another 40 years, and in God's perfect timing, God had a new plan for him. So this wasn't exactly a call or a text or an email. It was a burning bush. And we pick up the story here in chapter 3 of Exodus. Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the back of the desert and came to Mount Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed. Moses said, I need to take a look at this. Why is this not happening? And he hears his voice, "Moses, Moses." He says, "Here I am." Don't draw near this place. Take the sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. God says, here's the plan. I've seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt. I've heard their cry, and I know their sorrows. And so did Moses. That's why he was where he was now. And it's possible that for the past 40 years, he had been praying about this and asking for God's intervention and looking forward to the day when God would deliver Israel from Egypt. And yet now here it was before him, and he is being asked to take an active role in this. And so God continues to lay out his plan. And in verse 10, he says, come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. What might your reaction be? An enthusiastic, yes, this is the position I deserve and I've been trained to do? Or a reluctant, this is going to be a heavy job. This also could get one killed. And he starts to think it through. Moses is reluctant, hesitant, and he starts to think through the implications of this request. In verse 11, we have that key transitory word, but Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? God says, I will certainly be with you. Moses said, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, the God of your father sent me, they'll say to me, what's his name? They won't believe me. The children of Israel aren't going to believe me, and Pharaoh's not going to believe me. And he says to him, tell them, I am who I am, sent you. He says, okay. So that's objection number one. And there's the rest of chapter 3 is the dialogue dealing with God's response to his first objection. And so, well, who am I? Second one is, who sent me? And then the third one is recorded in chapter 4, the third objection. So after God responds to Moses' second objection, Moses answered and says, but suppose they won't believe me or listen to my voice. Say, the Lord hasn't appeared to you. So he tells him to throw his rod on the ground and it becomes a serpent. And he says, I'll perform miracles for you. Put your hand in your coat, it comes out leprous. Puts it back and it comes out clean. Okay, so the signs may be helpful. Verse 10 of chapter 4, then Moses said, oh my Lord, he's starting to really plead now. I'm not even very good at speaking. I'm horrible at it. I can't even get a sentence out. I'm just bad. You don't want me. I'm not the guy. I've never been good at speaking, and I'm not good at it now. And he's stuttering and upset and frustrated and telling God, I'm not the guy. This will be a disaster. The Lord said to him, who has made man's mouth? Who makes the mute, the deaf, the seeing, the blind? God says, by the way, I'm the guy helping you. I'm the creator of the universe. I can help you. I can give you what you need. I can give you the right words in the right order, and you can present them in the right way. You just need to say yes. You need to trust me. Now go. I'll be with your mouth, and I'll teach you what to say. Verse 13, but he said, oh my Lord, please send by the hand of whomever else you may send. Verse 14, so the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. God finally got upset here. And he says, I'll be with your mouth and I'll give you your brother Aaron and he'll help you and he'll be your spokesman and you shall take this rod in your hand with which you shall do the signs. Now go. And so God drew the line. It was going to be Moses. And the question might be, why did Moses resist? Did he seemed to think he couldn't do a good enough job? I was in a conversation with a man this week, not in this geography, Yet he has an upcoming assignment. He was concerned. And he called and he says, I don't think I can do a very good job. And I said, well, you're a real person with real feelings. And the Bible records many real people with real feelings about upcoming assignments. And they were all imperfect people who gave their imperfect efforts to accomplish God's perfect will. All they had to do was be willing to jump into the role. He says, it's interesting that you use the word imperfect because I do feel like I am a perfectionist. And now that I think about it, that is the root of my concern, is that I can't do a good enough job. Interestingly, he shared with a group of you when we were on the Iron Sharpens Iron call his concerns a little bit. And all of you said the same thing to him. Don't worry about it. Just do it. We're all doing this, and none of us are perfect. So we're looking forward to you presenting your effort, and we'll benefit from it. And so now he's working on it, and he's, I'll say, enthusiastic about it. So these are natural thoughts. Like in Hebrews, time would fail us to consider all of the other examples that are out there. Gideon, in Judges 6, was asked to go and fight against the Midianites. Now, in context, Gideon is in the region of Judah, and he's hiding from the Midianites because they would come and make raids and take all of their grain, all of their food. And so he's trying to thresh a little grain so he can feed his family, and he's hiding in this abandoned building. And then an angel of the Lord comes to him and says, well, let's turn there, Judges 6. Judges 6 and verse 12. The angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, the Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor. And he says, you've got to be kidding me. Mighty man of valor as I'm hiding here, trying not to get caught, feed my family. And he says, yes, I want you to go and defeat the Midianites. And verse 15, it says, oh my Lord, how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh and I'm the least in my father's house. You've got the wrong guy. And he says, I'll be with you. You'll defeat the Midianites. And then we know the story. So Gideon asks for a sign. Can you give me some sign? And so there was an offering that the angel of the Lord touched with his rod, and it consumed it all. And he says, okay, but I need another one. And the fleece, we might know about Gideon's fleece. And Gideon prayed that the ground would all be wet with dew, as it was this week, by the way. There was, I think it was Thursday morning, I woke up and there was dew all over the ground. We'd had rain this week, the humidity was high, and the temperature got low enough so that there was dew all over the ground. And so maybe it was a similar time of year where this prayer was prayed, and he said, let the ground be wet, but this fleece be dry. And it was. And then the next day, the ground was dry, and the fleece was soaking wet. He was wringing bowls of water out of it. And then a question for you. Have you ever prayed a Gideon's prayer? Have you ever asked for a sign in some way? That's a good topic of discussion for dinner or snacks afterwards. But so Gideon says, I'm not the man of valor. And then he compiles his resources, and it's 30,000 plus men. And so God says to him, let everyone go who's afraid, and 22,000 leave. And so now he's down to a third, and it just keeps getting whittled down until he's got 300. And so then it was clear that it would not be in any way attributed to their valor or their strength. It had to be from God. And God took Gideon to that point. He took Moses to that point. Esther fasted for 3 days and requested that everyone fast for 3 days. And she and her maids, it says, did likewise. 3 days. We all know what it's like after 24 hours, starting to feel weak, looking forward to a little caffeine. Imagine 2 days Some of you have fasted for 2 days. Now you're really getting weak, and by the end of 3 days, any illusions to your own physical strength are dissipating fast. You recognize how physical we are and recognize that you become very weak without food and water. So that's what they fasted for and said, this needs to come from God. It cannot be from anything that we do. And so they put it in God's hands, as Gideon did. There are many who will hold on to their excuses. If we turn over to Luke 14, there's a section here in the Gospel of Luke about commitment and about an invitation that can come and what our level of commitment optimally is so that God can work with us. And we opened the sermon today by considering the invitation that God has given us to become sons and daughters of his family. It says, now when one of those who sat at the table with him heard these things, he said, blessed is he who shall eat bread in the kingdom of God. So Christ takes this teaching moment here in Luke 14, 16. He says to him, a certain man gave a great supper and invited many. He sent his servant to say to those who were invited, come, for everything's ready. Dinner's ready. But they all with one accord began to make excuses. The first one said, I've bought a piece of ground. And I need to go and check it out. The other one says, I just bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I'm ready to test them. We could change that to today's vernacular. I just bought a new business, or I just bought new equipment or something. I just bought something, and I have a plan for it, and I need to go execute on that plan. Another one says, I've married a wife. I just got married. I can't come. So the servant came and reported these things to his master, and his master said, being angry, said, just go out and invite everyone. Invite anyone you can. Let's fill this hall up and forget them. Don't try to talk them out of it. Don't try to talk them into it. Just move on. And then in verse 14, or chapter 14, verse 25, this is a section that we often refer to in baptism counseling. Says, if anyone comes to me and doesn't hate or love less his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever doesn't bear his cross and come after me can't be my disciple. It says it's important to count the cost. And so, as we make that commitment, we don't know what may be requested of us. We don't know what we may be asked to do. So, I first of all want to make sure, or at this point, want to make sure that everyone understands how impressed, pleased, and thankful I am for you. In this role, over the last 3 years, I've had opportunity to see at a whole new level what you do for each other. And the love and the care and the concern that you express for each other, the ways that you serve each other, the ways that you say yes. Because as I look out across this audience, as I look at a spreadsheet that has names on it, every one of you is engaged in some way, serving or preparing to serve. And it's impressive to see. As it worked out, we met in the conference room this week in Ohio at the home office, and the seat that I sat in happened to be right underneath a plaque, a large sign or plaque that has the vision of the United Church of God on it, and I'll read that to you. A church led by God's Holy Spirit, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies, with all doing their share and growing in love to fulfill God's great purpose for humanity, to bring many children to glory. That comes straight from the scripture, Ephesians 4 and Hebrews 2:10. And so it's a church led by God's Spirit, joining it together with every part doing their share to contribute towards the vision that God has. We'll have a D&E meeting this week. We'll look at the service organization chart as we always do. And we'll ask, What needs to change? Is there anything that needs to change? And as it's worked out over the last few years, if we took a look at the chart then and the chart now, there's a lot of differences. There were a lot of roles occupied by those who are no longer in those roles. And some have passed away, and some have moved away, and some are just at the point where they were ready to hand it off. And the good news is that in every case, one of you was right there, ready, willing, and able to say yes and take on those responsibilities so that the rest of you are well served. That has always been true. It's beautiful to see. One of the last few months when we got together with the young adults, as we're looking out at the group of young married people and young people that have invested in themselves and their education and are sitting there ready to learn, and then there's a group of kids banging away on some toys in another room, and this guy who's getting a little older started to get a little sentimental and start thinking back. Just 20 years ago, 20-ish years ago, actually it was more like 25 years ago now, when the Scribers first came to Phoenix, and he got together a young adult group. So here were the Scribers, about the same age as Carrie and I are, sitting in a seat teaching young adults, and I was sitting in that audience, and Logan, and many of you were playing in the other room. And now here it is, a generation later, where the Scribers are not fully retired. They're still serving, but they're not in the role anymore. I'm sitting there. We have the group that was playing in the living room sitting here in a new group playing in the living room. And we can see how fast those seats change. And now it's your job to prepare for taking on these roles and responsibilities, and our job to help you get there. And we're doing it. That's the beautiful thing. We can see how it's happening. How as a congregation, and now we have teens and preteens and little ones and babies being born and blessed every year, and it's continuing. It's God's plan. And generation after generation after generation, we keep handing it off, and there's blessings that come as a result of the knowledge of God's truth and the implementation of God's laws in our lives and the blessings that come as a result of that. And we can see it. So it's such a pleasure to be working with a group that says yes and is willing. I'd like to ask you, what have you said yes to? If you were to go back in your mental journal, what challenging thing have you said yes to? I can say that there are many things that some of you had said yes to. At some point, Grant and others and Bryce and Matthew DeVinny learned to play an instrument and became practiced and became proficient. Mr. Kohler, Christina Fogelson became proficient so that they could serve the congregation by playing music for accompaniment for hymns. There was one camp director that was preparing for a marathon. And talked a little bit about the training. Some of you have done marathons, some have done triathlons, and you know about the training. And then one lady says, I don't think I'm up for a marathon, but maybe couch to 5K would be my program. And so she was ready to sign up for couch to 5K, and that's a program of training. But regardless of what we might say yes to, we then have to learn to say no to other things. Because if we start committing to something, then whatever we were doing with that time before can't be done anymore. So we have to say no to distraction and time wasters and non-nutritional behaviors, physically and spiritually. If we're training for something physically, then there's some things we can't eat or can't do. As we train spiritually, the same way. We have to be careful of the nutrition that comes into our minds and our hearts. So then we start to train as we say yes. What do we train? Train your heart. We've got five things that we'll train here. Train our heart. 1 Samuel 16:9 says, God looks at the heart. He looks at our core motive. So we have to train our heart to align with him. We have to train our feet. We have to be willing to respond to that call, follow me. That was the invitation that Christ gave to those who became his disciples. Follow me. Come and be my student, but more than that, disciple. And if we're going to be disciples, we have to train our feet to follow. We recently studied that. In the last sermon that I was with you, we were together on, we talked about walking worthy of the calling with which we've been called. Walk worthy. Put your feet in the right direction of the invitation with which you've been invited. Train your hands. Give your skills, your talents, your interests, and your aptitudes to God. Romans 12:1 says, present your bodies a living sacrifice, which is your reasonable service. Sounds like a lot, but it's a reasonable service when we consider what's been offered us. Train your mind. Bring every thought into captivity, as we're encouraged to do in 2 Corinthians 10:2-6. Casting down every argument and every high thing that exalts itself against God in our minds, and bring every thought into captivity. Peter says, grow in grace and knowledge. Continue to develop the mind and the spirit. Grow. Train our mouths. The last thing we train, or that we'll explore today that we train, is our mouths. Ephesians 4:29, which we're in Ephesians 4 now. We'll get to Ephesians 4:29. It says, let no corrupt communication proceed from your mouth, but what is necessary for edification, which means to build, which means to develop, especially intellectually and spiritually. So with our words, we should be building, encouraging. Our words can be very powerful. God's the creator of the universe, and he said, let there be light, and there was light. It was with his word. John 1:1 talks about, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God, and everything was created through the Word. We create with our words. We destroy with our words as well. So recognize the power of the words. As you say yes to God, it's important to think about what you say, every syllable. Proverbs 15 has much to say in this regard. You could read through Proverbs 15. Multiple references to what we say. The following chapter, Proverbs 16:23, says, a wise person adds learning to their lips. Continues to grow and develop and learn how to speak better and for better outcomes for the benefit of others. So this is what we train. This is how we train as we consider the wonderful invitation that God has given to us, the wonderful opportunity to be members of the God family. What can God do with you? Say yes and find out. You are important to God.